The person that I am interviewing wrote the lyrics to that song, the original title of which was Corey Doesn't Like It. His name is Jacob Arendis, and you may know him as the editor of the underground newspaper Mother's News, or the singer of the band Strawberry Band. And most recently, he has an exhibition coming up called Animal Year at Heavy Manners Library in Los Angeles. It is opening on October 6th. And that show documents the year that he spent making a stuffed animal every single day. So we talked about eyeballs and cuteness and immediacy, commercialism, aggression, many other topics. And I'm going to play that interview for you right now. So stay tuned. The eyeballs. Where do you source your eyeballs from?
Great question. I get them from a place I affectionately call the eyeball store. It's near me. I don't know if this is like a secret or not, because they have a finite amount of them. The real danger is that I go there and they're not there, and then I have to quit. I have to quit what I'm doing. So I'm going to keep it under my lid for the moment as to where the eyeballs come from. But I will say that the place is lovely. It's cavernous. It's vast. It's a little bit like, you know, where they bring the Holy Grail at the end of Indiana Jones?
Yes, absolutely.
It's a little bit like that. There's a bunch of aisles and all the lights are off and you have to turn on the individual aisle light. And pre-pandemic, they served free coffee and like supermarket Hydrox cookies, which was a great vibe. And I think any store that has free coffee, I don't know why more places don't do that, because you just get jacked up and you buy a bunch of dumb shit.
Yeah, it seems like a really good customer enticement strategy for sure.
Yeah, and it's a great store too, because you have to buy, it's like, it's not really made for the individual, it's made for people that have jewelry companies and stuff. So you can't buy just one of anything. But there's so much stuff, and you kind of end up just putting something in your pocket. It's nice. It's like, it has a little bit of intrigue to it.
Yeah, I think an intriguing shopping experience, especially for an object as inherently intriguing as an eyeball, seems to really fit the task to the result.
To the guys, it really, you put the eyes in and it pops. You know, that's like a mythological standard.
Yes.
There are certainly folk arts where you don't paint the eyes in, because otherwise the vase is going to break and the wall is going to tumble and the dragon is going to fly off. But I was so excited when I found the eyes that one of the stuffed animals that I made the day that I bought all the eyeballs was just the box that the eyeballs come in. It's like a small shoebox sized cardboard box with packing tape on it that has three eyeballs on the outside of it, which is exactly how it looks, you know, in the eye.
I looked at the website and found, I went through and read all of their little names, and I found that one particularly intriguing. Is there something, the placement and shape of the eyeballs is, so I've noticed most of them have the vertical cat eye slit. Do you have any that are more dog pupil? Have you ever seen a goat pupil eye?
Great question. No, I have some of the regular, just round, classic mammal, or not mammal, just a round eyeball. I have a bunch of those. The cat eye is wonderful because it gives you the context of like, this is in fact an animal.
Right.
The goat I've never seen before. They're freaky.
Yeah.
They have those eyeballs. And generally, when you make a stuffed animal, you know, you're making it as a proxy for affection. It's something that you hug when you need a hug. So it's important that you are able to identify with it. And when the eyeballs are too fucked up, it makes things difficult.
I've noticed a trend. There's like a hip bookstore near me that sells stuffed animal versions of really nasty things, like either biblical plagues or disease particles. For a while, there was a series that were all the like anthropomorphized germs that cause STDs. And I was wondering kind of what your take on that is. It sort of reminds me of how we have sanitized and cuddlified bears, which are quite dangerous animals, into the teddy. But for some reason, I have always found this particular sanitization of, say, like a chlamydia germ into a little cuddly thing to be somewhat distasteful. And I was wondering if you had a thought on that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, a lot of ways you make an artwork out of something. As an artist, you might paint something that horrifies you as a way to try to control it. Something that you're concerned with. There might be a great psychological benefit to having a cute and cuddly version of it. Squeeze and cuddle. Although maybe chlamydia is not. That's not exactly what you want to be squeezing and cuddling. But the other thing is that it's funny how it works, but there's a big difference between things that are cute and things that are beautiful. Well, beauty is a strong word. You can see that in everywhere, but I should say there's a difference between things that are pretty and things that are cute. Things that are pretty confined, they hew closely to design standards, symmetry, golden ratios, and so on. But acuteness needs to have an element of disgust. Cuteness needs to be a little bit gross, and it should inspire in you the feeling of a mother seeing her child, or any parent seeing their child, and knowing that you love it, and also knowing that it's disgusting, but that your love is special to it. You know what I mean? The love of a parent doesn't really activate until the child is actually doing something bad, and that's when the moment. That's the full fire of love, is I'm cleaning. I'm trying to change this baby's diaper and it's pissing in my face, but I still love it. So, at the same degree, when you're trying to make something cute, you might think, I don't want to make, I want to make it cute. It's going to be lovely and everyone's going to like it. You got to make it a little bit gross. You want to make it a little bit disgusting and a little bit foreign from you, enough that there's a gap that you, the viewer, has to overcome. And having done that work, it makes you love it even more.
Would
I
you
was actually just talking to my mom earlier today about the show. She was excited about it, and she told me that her favorite one was I made a fish head, a stuffed animal of just a fish's head, like a cut off with the blood and everything. And she was like, I couldn't believe it. Wow, that's my favorite one. I just, who would have thought it? And I was like, yeah, that's why you like it. You like it because it feels like you're the only one that could like it. And that's special,
Have you considered using the sculptures as a sort of divinatory tool or personality test in that somebody's favorite then indicates something deeper about their personality?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not so interested in, I mean, I'm interested in people greatly, but I'm not so interested in plumbing their depths so succinctly. But when I was doing the show, this show originally ran in Providence at a space nearby. And I would just, I was also the gallery mind. I was there and just, serving coffee and donuts and stuff. And that was a wonderful experience because I got to just walk up to people and say, if you have a favorite, please let me know what it is. And it was always really surprising to me. I mean, I can look at the batch and think of, well, these are ones that I think everyone would like. And these are ones that I think some people would like. And these are the ones that I like. And every time I asked someone their favorite, it was shocking. So that was lovely to see that, there's many hours in the day and there's many days in the year. There's many ways to approach life. It's nice to see someone say, I love this millipede or whatever. And I'm like, wow, okay, cool, far out. But I didn't think like, well, you like the millipede, you're like a foot freak or something. It's like that's I'm not
Sure.
I didn't delve, no.
Right. Okay. So, and I guess it would take probably a pretty large sample set to see if you could trace, are there patterns in people liking a particular one or not?
Yeah, absolutely. Also, I think even though it's a pretty big sample set, it's over 200 of these guys, it's not like a complete cluster of archetypes. You
Right.
know what I mean? There's not a magician or a hierophant or an empress necessarily. There's like, maybe there's too many different kinds of bugs to have utility as an oracle.
On the other hand, I mean, given the structure of the animal kingdom, having too many different kinds of bugs seems pretty true to life.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
Especially if many of them were beetles.
Yeah, there's a lot of beetles, huh?
Yeah, I think so. I can't remember which naturalist it was who said that one of the only things we can know for sure about God, if he or she exists, is that they're very fond of beetles because there's more kinds of beetles than kinds of anything else. I think. I know that you had written something about how you would take a few little notes about the day that you made each one on, because this has a kind of diaristic quality to it. You made one every single day for a year. And I had sort of two related semi-questions about that. So did you notice that there was kind of a particular correlation between quality of day and quality of workmanship?
That is a great question. I find that no.
Okay.
No, there's a variety of factors and they kind of balance each other out. You know, when a day is exciting and I'm doing a lot, then the spark of inspiration is ready at hand. Mm-hmm. A day that drags on, maybe I'm depressed or whatever, you know, I'm not so into it. But then on the other hand, a day that's exciting has a lot going on to it. And by the time I get to making a stuffed animal, I really want to go to bed. And then I'm like, ah, geez, I got to do this, you know? So the quality of workmanship isn't necessarily higher on those days, although the guys themselves might be more inspired. Versus on days when I have a lot of time, I might be just dragging ass and there's nothing, you know, there's just flies in the old dome piece.
Sure.
Nothing going on.
But then you have the time to do a really beautifully rendered kind of nothing of an idea, maybe.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Also, I found that like when there's a bunch of crazy days in a row, then I would say like, all right, I really gotta do a good one. Mm-hmm. And then there would be a good one. And sometimes too, it's like you have a great idea, but you're like, dude, this is an hour's worth of work. And mm-hmm. it's 2:30 a.m. Mm-hmm. And perhaps I'm not alone. I would rather not be doing an hour's worth of work. So those get saved for another day.
I saw that you also said that you would sometimes just, if you were, for example, staying at a friend's house or traveling and you hadn't brought a full sewing kit with you, that you would sometimes have to make them just out of whatever fabric you had to hand, be it your own clothing or whatever else. Do you have kind of particular favorite examples of that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredible the lack of preparation I really did. But sometimes I would just forget. I'd be like, oh, I'm staying over at someone's house. I think there's a really good one of a man thing. He's like a swamp creature. It's kind of a companion swamp, not a companion, but like an alternate swamp creature to Swamp Thing. It was kind of more famous. Man thing is like a shambling mass of swamp material that formed humanoid form for a variety of reasons. Anyway, I made a really good one of that out of just like a piece of a torn handkerchief. That came out, I think, really elegant. And I think that's something I'm really interested in from a design standpoint, is economy and elegance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you would see it, even as a fan of the man thing, you wouldn't necessarily be so impressed. You'd say, well, it's not really a lot of work. It's just a single stitch. But I think it's extraordinary what you can accomplish with just a single stitch and a piece of a handkerchief.
And so this is kind of leading to the bigger question is, why did you pick stuffed animal making over any other medium in the entire world?
Yeah, great question. I don't really know. Looking back on it, I think I had made one and it was satisfying.
Mm.
And then the next day I made another one. And that was also satisfying. And I just decided I'm going to keep doing this. And I was greatly inspired by a tape that a friend of mine put out. Lazy Magnet is the name of the band. And the tape was called 365 Days of the Blues, where he wrote a song every day for a year. And the feeling I got was that he started the year off making these fun songs, and he ended the year making these great songs. And he came out of it with this fearless energy. Mm-hmm. It was very inspiring. And I thought, not necessarily do I want to get that with stuffed animals, but I want to get that with something or with design. And looking back on it, I think that the project really functioned for me as a sort of school. I didn't go to school. I didn't go to college because it was too expensive. But from the people that I talked to who had gone to art school, it seemed the main thing they got out of it was that they learned to work through periods of low inspiration. They learned to divorce the part of their mind that wants to do something from the part of their mind that can do something. And I thought that was really compelling. So I decided on this project to do just one of something every day for a year, just as a way to force my mind to deal with itself. Also, it presents a lot of interesting challenges dealing volumetrically and stuff. And it wasn't something that I really ever done before. So, and it's harder to critique. That's the other thing. If I had done a drawing a year, a day, or a song a day, I would be able to look back on those days and say, wow, that drawing is not very good, or this song sounds like garbage. But with a stuffed animal, it's like I'm primed to love each and every one of them. Even though I recognize that some are better than the other ones, I truly do feel love towards all of them. Even the, you know, the worst ones made on the worst days are still compelling to me. And that's has a strong motivational factor. You know, never did I look back and say, I'm making a bunch of trash. This is a useless exercise. Every day I had a satisfaction.
I think that's really, really profound. And I think there really is something to the lovability of the ones that are in some way somewhat more poorly rendered, because I find there is a kind of pathos that then lends even more affection to it. I'm thinking of, I don't know if you've read foundational Protestant text, Little Women, but one of the characters has a hospital for damaged dolls that her siblings have cast off, and that really hit me right in the guts when I was a kid.
Yeah, it's funny. I didn't really think of the emotional context of this project until I had sort of dusted them off a couple of years ago for the show in Providence. And I laid them all out and I really had this strong emotional reaction, which was surprising to me. I'd always thought of it as like, you know, this sort of intellectual exercise or this funny challenge. But it was nice to look at them all and realize like, man, these are, you know, you look back on a year of your life sort of arbitrarily chosen, and there's good days and there's bad days, and there's days you feel great and days you feel horrible, and days you acted honorably and days that were less than honorable. And it's a rare opportunity to look back on an abstracted calendar like that and say, I still love every one of these days. You know, I love the me from each one of those instances, which is how I felt looking back on all these dudes, looking back on the ones that took 5 minutes and the ones that took an hour. Yeah, really splendid, really splendid event.
Absolutely. Was there a particular significance to the start date?
No, it wasn't really planned. It was just, like I said, I just made one. I think I was testing out the sewing machine and then I just kept going. And I remember the third night, which is really the first night, because that was the first night that I decided I was going to keep doing this. Made one and then immediately got on a bus to a party, and I brought my guy with me and I was like, look, I'm going to do this every day for a year. And everyone's like, wow, all right, why? And looking back on it now, I can't believe I blabbed so much about it. Because usually you talk about a plan too early in advance and kind of get all the good energy out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, I sort of felt like, well, I told everyone at the party I was going to do this, so I got to keep doing it.
Sure, yeah, the stick-to-itiveness kicked in.
Yeah.
So something about these being stuffed animals and then other things that I've noticed about your work, I'm thinking of the proposed exhibition that you have around the orange and white painting, and also Jervin's Clasp, and also the fact that your website that serves as the repository for all of your writing is shaped like and navigated like a big castle. And it seems like there's this really wonderful and intriguing through line of playfulness and whimsy and kind of spontaneity that I feel like is missing in a lot of what I think of as mainstream contemporary art. And so I was wondering if there are other people whose work kind of falls along these lines, this kind of shared collaborative imagination, spirit of playfulness that you really resonate with, whether they're kind of within the art world proper or not.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly artists that I admire, but I don't think of them as being, yeah, there's artists that are that are playful, I don't think of them as being necessarily whimsical. You know, James Ensor, I really like. Paul Klee is very playful. I don't think of myself as like, even though we just had a big discourse on what is cute, I don't think of myself as really doing like a lot of cute stuff. I just try to do what's lively and appealing to me. So I don't really touch base with a lot of like contemporary cute stuff, you know, the super flat guy or like the urban vinyl people, or that stuff doesn't really appeal to me.
Yeah, I feel like the kind of crucial difference between your work and that kind of thing is that kind of thing, especially the super flat, it's playing into a language that is much more commercial. And I think, you know, sometimes it uses that language to make interesting points about branding and commercialization of life and the kind of flattening effect of capitalism on global culture and all that kind of thing. But it feels, and I think this is sort of how it's successful, it feels really inorganic. Whereas I think that your work really, it's almost like emerging from a kind of kombucha SCOBY where the different constituent particles are like the underground music world or some things from video games and fantasy novels, but then it's all sort of distilled through a very unique perspective that results in a finished product that is quite different from any of its source material.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. I mean, I think a key thing for me is like this sort of childish feeling of like animism, of, you know, everything's a little guy. So that's kind of how I like approach a lot of things, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, look at this little guy, you might say. And the things that I make, I think of them as being alive in the world and running around. Even things that are just like the newspaper, that's not really, you don't think of that as a little guy, but I think of that as being alive the way a fungus is alive, that it grows and spreads and sneaks into little areas and, you know, cracks open a rock and digests the minerals and creates a rich topsoil. So yeah, I would say that it's less about the focus on adorableness and more about life.
I really like the metaphor of the newspaper as being like a fungus and the cracking open of rocks to create the topsoil, because I think that we're in a weird historical moment where there's a lot of kind of, and I don't want to sound like I'm a grumpy old person talking about, because I'm not especially, but talking about like, oh, there's a lot of fake people out there, or a lot of kind of fake underground. But I think we're at a point where a lot of the options available to people tend to be these kind of commercialized things. And some of the old school methods of connectivity that used to be really fertile are kind of being abandoned as perhaps too labor intensive or insufficiently private or what have you. And I think it is really great when we have particular artists or projects or thoughts that kind of like steer us back to these more organic feeling, more kind of mycelial networks and ways of connecting with other people.
Yeah.
I really like that a lot.
I mean, one thing about me is that I'm like kind of, I can get kind of punchy, and oftentimes I'll have an idea that's reactive, or I'll think like, you know, there'll be a big story in the news about how, oh, you know, Amazon is taking over and web stores are taking over and the store as we know it is going to be gone. And so I sort of started thinking about that. I was like, oh, I should open a store. That seems like a fun thing, you know? So I did that for a couple of years in Worcester, ran a store really inspired by these programs that are saying there's no need to have a store anymore. And then the newspaper, it was the same, similar riff. I mean, there was a lot in the stew, but part of that was, you know, the rise of, you know, the commercialization of the web and more news agencies moving to it and people saying that the newspaper was done for. And I just got this feeling of like, oh yeah, newspaper, there's suddenly a lot of wiggle room in there. I can get in there and muck around. And it's almost like, you know, when there's a factory that closes down and then 10 years later, a bunch of people move in and it's this whole other thing. So I felt that way about these structures, about moving into doing a newspaper. But it worked out great for me. I mean, it's like, to some degree, there's just a gimmick of it. Everyone's doing this thing and I'm doing this other thing.
Sure.
So that was very valuable, but also it has a lot of benefits over a website or some other, you know, electronic format, and that it's just there. You get it and you still, you always, you have it until you destroy it or leave it behind somewhere. So, I mean, I got a lot of letters from people saying like, I found this in my friend's bathroom, or one lady wrote to me years later and said, I was hiking through the Hollywood Hills and I found it sticking out of someone's trash can and it looked cool. So I just grabbed it and it was great. And now I'm writing you. I mean, you can just stumble upon a website, obviously, but there's something special about, that it's just always there. It's creeping around, blowing in the wind, literally.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are you imagining? I know that you're saying that you're going to be making a few more stuffed animals to go along with the show. Because I guess so, the stuffed animals that are in the show were never given to other people. They were always your little guys who continued to live with you. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. Although they didn't, you know, it's not like I had them all in a pile on my bed. I was pretty careful about, you know, I wanted to save them all.
Right.
I did give one of them away as a birthday present and I had to borrow it back. But that's no problem. You know, I'm still friends with that person, so it's no big deal. That one is like definitely is grimier than the other one.
It's had a little bit more of a life out in the world and has come back to the home fold with stories to tell.
Yeah. And there was a quilt that I made at the end of that year, which is like, you know, when you're sewing, it's a subtractive process. You start off with a bolt of cloth and then you winnow it down into these little pieces and sew them together. So there's all these little pieces left over. And I made a quilt out of them and it's, you know, it's fun to look at and see like little bits of everybody. Mm-hmm. But I had, what happened? I left that behind at some house that I lived at and then it moved to another house and then lived on the porch. It was a dog blanket for a while and then it just disappeared. But I got it back. I finally figured out who had it and I got it back. That one's been on a wild ride.
Yeah. Yeah, that's quite the story. Is that going to be included in the show or is it just nice to have a
Yeah.
Great. Cool.
Yeah, that'll be in the show. That'll be in the show. It's funny too. It's like, that's of all the stuffed animals, that's the one that really comforted the most people.
Yeah.
And animals and mice and stuff.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's really beautiful to think about. And so you'll be having a kind of an edition of stuffed animals that viewers of the show or fans of your internet presence will be able to purchase at some point?
That's right.
Cool.
That's right. Yeah, they're going to be at the show and they'll also, they're having a website. I mean, they have a website and they'll put them on their store for their website. And then when I get back, I have another stuffed animal show in December and I'm making a new batch for that. Just like, not even so much as a moneymaker. It's just so nice. It's so nice for people to have them. I made a batch of them last December for a craft show, just to have something to go to this show. And it was like the first event I had really done since, you know, the beginning of the pandemic. And I sold a bunch of these to people that were excited to get them. And later I got so many nice notes from people saying like, I had this guy through some pretty difficult times this year, or like, you know, I was quarantined and I didn't have anybody. And I was just hugging this little guy and watching horror movies. And it was so nice. So it's really like such a delight to think about that. Like as a, you know, as an artist, I don't think of myself as adhering to a lot of contemporary success metrics, you know, having a gallerist or getting picked up by a arts blog or whatever. But I really do have a lot of other things. And one of them is that the artwork that I make makes people feel good and feel a connection with the world. And then they tell me about it and I feel great.
I feel like that's kind of the exact mentality why I wanted to interview you for the punk radio show specifically, because I feel like that's kind of a uniting thread of a lot of the musical artists that we have on here as well, in terms of people who are kind of avoiding the major label move or the kind of art world equivalent thereof, because it's about the kind of more person-to-person connections rather than, you know, you're kind of being financially insulated from ordinary suffering.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's funny, you look at this stuff and you wouldn't really think, you know, a punk made this or this is punk. But my experience of punk is less about anger and more about being immediate, you know, cutting out a middleman and getting right to the heart of the matter. So yeah, it's funny. You have these moments, or as a band, I think about this sometimes. I, you know, have friends that are in big bands and talking to them, and it just seems like, man, this is just a job for you. This doesn't even seem like a good job. Mm-hmm. You know, like you're driving around and you're playing from people and you're kind of far from them and you don't have the energy, versus like you play a show in a basement and you just feel like you're just licking the eyeball of God. It's incredible, you know, and everyone's going bananas and dripping sweat, and it's an ecstatic experience. So that kind of immediacy is like, that's what I seek. You know, I wouldn't want to be a Gerhard Richter selling this painting for $1 million or whatever to some hedge fund manager. I would rather be making 50 of these dudes, and everyone that gets it gets to squeeze it and love it and tell me all about it later. I would help.
I think particularly, like, I work in art appraisal as my day job, but sometimes I do go out to the climate controlled storage facility for.
Oh yeah! Wow, what's that like?
It's wild. The people who work there are really, really nice. There is no coffee, because you would not be able to spill it on someone's beautiful David Hockney or whatever, even though they're all meticulously packaged. But it is also kind of funny, because within the meticulous packaging, it'll just be like kind of in like a stack of crates in this big warehouse.
And
it's so funny, having gotten into the art world and art world jobs through loving art a lot, and then finding that, you know, oh wow, yeah, for a lot of the people who have the resources actually to own some of the really good stuff, a lot of the time they don't have it in their homes. They're not having it in a place where people can see and enjoy it. And it'll be brought out for visiting shows. And I'm not even trying to kind of knock people who want to make sure that their art is preserved for a long time, but there's a really big difference between having, like, I have one of your stuffed animals on my couch with me to hang out with on the days that I work from home. And there's a big difference between that and then having a Jasper Johns wrapped in many layers of plastic in a wooden crate in a building far away from your house.
So depressing. I feel like it's really just, there's two things going on though. There's Jasper Johns, who is lovely and fun and made these practical jokes.
Yes.
And then, you know, and he's doing his thing. He's trying to touch the infinite just like everyone else is. And, you know, he's partying with his buds and having a great time. And then there's the aftermarket, which is like, excuse me, it just doesn't matter like what it was. It's just that it holds value. That's sort of what I love about the NFT craze now, is like how all that stuff looks so dumb.
Uh-huh.
Regardless of your feeling on it as a technology, you got to admit that it looks completely, totally idiotic. And so it's nice to sort of have this leveling of like, oh yeah, that it really never mattered, or it doesn't, or it hasn't mattered for, you know, 20 years.
Sure.
The ideas behind an artwork or its execution, it's really just a holder of value.
Yeah, it's that's something I spent a lot of my professional life having to think about and quantify, and yeah. That's very bizarre.
There's still, you know, an infinite number of reasons to pursue art,
right?
And to seek it out.
Yeah, I have some friends who are musicians, and various of them have gone through the kind of thing of, you know, and it makes sense that if you spend a lot of time perfecting your skill at a particular thing and you spend a lot of time creating it, that you do want people to see it. You want the people to see it to like it. I don't think any of us are at the sort of totally like ego secure point where we would be happy with playing something that we're excited about, that we loved, that we put a lot of love into, and having someone say, eh, not for me. And so, of course, it can be really disappointing if you put something out there and then people don't like it. But I think it's also like, if you're at the point where you wouldn't just kind of do it for yourself, regardless of whether you feel like showing it to people or not, that's when it's like, that's kind of a sad juncture to get to.
Yeah.
So what do you have next in the works? Do you? I know you're saying you're doing another show in December. Do you have some other kind of big project that you're working on, or is it too early and secret to say?
For that show, I think it'll be an iteration of the Sphinx design working on, something special around that. That's just something I'm doing.
Sure.
The main project next is, I'm working on some new music, which is exciting.
Fantastic.
I haven't done that for a while.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to write music for you know, for solo work that would be translatable to a band, which is kind of how I've been doing it for the past couple of years. But that's daunting, you know, that's every time I sit down to do that, I need to figure out a new trick.
Yeah.
But I have some new tricks, so I'm happy about
Great.
It.
I may, the interview, ask you to share some of those, or during, actually, if you feel like sharing them with our listeners.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I have nothing to show at the moment.
Oh, not the music yet, but the tricks.
Oh, the tricks. Yeah, I mean, the big thing is, like, it's tough, but as you get older, it's harder to separate the time when you are making something from the time that you are thinking about it. That's really the key. That's the main thing. So it's like, I find it helpful to just sort of set a goal and to just blast beyond it. So like with this, from a songwriting perspective, I've been writing songs not as myself, not necessarily as a character, but thinking about friends of mine, and say, you know, what's a song for Mickey? How can I write a song for Mickey? How can I write a song for Carlos? And then it's funny because I don't think about what's something I would do or what's a good idea. I just open my mouth and my impersonation of Mickey comes out and it's a great song because all of her songs are great. That's one little trick. I mean, of course they're my songs at the end of the day, but I've been enjoying thinking about that using a fractured identity as a way to avoid the critic.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really clever. I like that a lot.
I know the song is crazy, but Ziggy Stardust wrote it, you know, not David Bowie. So.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't know. Just David Bowie.
Yeah. I find that I always have to have a really distinct boundary between outfits that I wear when I'm performing music and then what I would wear as normal clothes for kind of similar reasons.
Yeah. It's a switch.
Yeah. Just like, okay, I'm putting on my armor now. I can go out there.
Yeah, big time.
So because this is a music show, do you have any songs that you would like to recommend that I can play for our listeners?
Ooh, I don't know. Man, the music that I listen to over and over again, I don't know if it's really appropriate for this show.
That was Lazy Magnet, Species-Wide Mass Suicide. You are listening to 90.7 KBOO, Life During Wartime. And it's about 11:11 p.m.